Three messages before we get started. If you're a tech entrepreneur, don't you have unique legal needs that the average lawyer can't help you with? That's why you need Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. If you read his articles on VentureBeat, you know that he can help you with issues like raising money or issuing stock options or even deciding whether to form a corporation. Scott Edward Walker is the entrepreneur's lawyer. See him at walkercorporatelaw.com. And do you remember when I interviewed Sarah Sutton Fell about how thousands of people pay for her job site? Look at the biggest point that she made. She said that she has a phone number on every page of her site because, and here's a stat, 95% of the people who call end up buying. Most people, though, don't call her, but seeing a real number increases their confidence in her and they buy. So try this. Go to grasshopper.com and get a phone number that will make your company sound professional. Add it to your site and see what happens. Grasshopper.com. And remember Patrick Buckley, who I interviewed? He came up with an idea for an iPad case. He built a store to sell it, and in a few months, he generated about $1 million in sales. Well, the platform he used is Shopify. If you have an idea to sell anything, set up your store on Shopify.com because Shopify stores are designed to increase sales. Plus, Shopify makes it easy to set up a beautiful store and manage it. Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart and the place where you watch entrepreneurs as they teach you how they built their businesses so that you can go out there, build your own company, and do what today's guest is doing, share what you learn. So, big question for today is, how does a company that was launched in an attic become a $100 million a year business? Joining me is Adam Strum, founder of Wine Enthusiast Companies, which sells wine and wine accessories and publishes Wine Enthusiast Magazine. Adam, welcome. It's good to meet you.
Thank you. Delighted to be here. And I think you really encapsulated the history of our business and where we started and where we humble beginnings, as you mentioned, the attic, and where we are today with about 200 employees and over $100 million in revenue. But we did, I'm very proud to show my daughter here, who is on the scale.
Yeah, let's take a look at that.
Yeah. There she is sitting on the scale in the attic. And that's my wife. Very happy to see that the baby's weighing in. And today she is our internet manager, director of internet. So, and now we're out of the attic, though. It's about our fifth facility. We have a 200,000 square foot facility here in Mount Kisco, where we ship major wine cellars to consumers all over the world. Wine racks, corkscrews, glassware. We also have a media business. We are influential in the wine world. We have over 700,000 readers of our magazine, Wine Enthusiasts. Maybe some of your viewers, your visitors may be aware of our logo, which appears not only on our branded goods, which we manufacture all over the world, but also on our magazine, which is authoritative, and we have a whole staff of journalists. We have an office in Rome, an office in Bordeaux, an office in San Francisco, and they rate and review and visit wineries and give consumers direction about wine.
And Adam, is this a bootstrap company that you built in the attic?
Yeah, we started it in the attic. I was my dad was in the wine business. He sold wine. I started in wine as well. When I got out of university, I sold wine. But wine was a very different business in those days in the late 70s and early 80s. It was a nascent neophyte business. Very few people were interested in wine. You wouldn't see wine on TV. You'd see a cocktail. But today you see wine proliferating, magazines, newspapers, every place where people have panache and style, wine generally seems to appear. So the interesting thing is we identified a niche early in 1979. My wife was a television producer. I was in wine sales. And we could afford to start a little mail order catalog. In those days, we produced and processed orders with memory typewriters. Computers weren't even invented. So the orders were processed. And we started in an attic in our home. First year, we had 100 orders. This year, we probably will have 750,000 orders. So that's a little bit of a transference, I think, Andrew.
Let me see if I understand this, though. And it looks like, there we go. Our cameras froze for a minute, but they came back up. Is it bootstrapped? Is it all your own personal investment in the business, or do you guys take any outside funding?
Well, yes, it was really bootstrapped. Little by little, we were able to float money early on with these large wine cellars, and in some ways it was self-financing. Our customers self-financed us, and early on, I have to admit.
What'd you start off selling? I see that you've got wine. I see wine accessories on your website, as I mentioned, and you held up the magazine. What was the beginning?
Well, the real power of our business is wine accessories. We identified this niche that there really wasn't a place to buy a corkscrew, to buy a wine glass, to buy anything to protect wine. So that was our unique advantage when we created a product that, and we were really pioneers in this area. I mean, it's sort of intimidating for many people to pull a cork out of a bottle. And if you went to many homes in the United States, even today, and you woke up, if you had a cork bottle of champagne, many people don't have the appropriate vessel to serve champagne in, or a sparkling wine. And that is where we got our start. That was our niche.
You started out in direct sales, catalog sales, accessories. What did you see? What was the opportunity that you saw that led you to start the business?
Well, I was in the wine. I was selling wine, mm-hmm. and every once in a while we look for a corkscrew. There were nowhere to be found. So the first thing we did, my wife and I, working out of our home, is we put a little ad in a gourmet magazine, sixth of a page, and for a corkscrew. And that was really the beginning of the wine enthusiast. After that, we identified the most affordable way to market and reach consumers was via direct mail. And this was sort of the beginnings of the catalog direct marketing industry. And that was, they were interesting times. You know, we first year we had 100 orders. I mean, I was working still as a salesperson because we had to put bread on the table. And my wife was commuting into the city doing, she was a TV producer. Commercials, did TV commercials.
How did that first corkscrew ad do? How did it perform?
Fairly well. It was an interesting corkscrew. It was actually, they're called the screw pull, still exists today. Mm-hmm. It wasn't our own. Today, more than 90% of the products in our catalog, we manufacture and develop on our own. But at that point in time, it was someone else's genius. It's actually an inventor in Texas called Herb Allen. It's the guy that invented the oil rig, by the way. Huh. And this is one of his minor achievements.
What was it about this corkscrew that was so impressive that you said, I've got to sell it?
Excellent question. Well, the answer is it was very easy. And, you know, many people were very challenged in pulling a cork out of a bottle. You know, there aren't many businesses where the closure complicates the consumption of the product, and wine was one of them. And, you know, I identified that. And so this is really the real nascence of the business. Then, in the early 80s, we identified a need for storing wine. People started to collect wine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me slow it down. I want to take this story very slowly so that I can fully absorb this. You know how I am. You've heard my interviews. You know how I am about business. I want to understand every part of it.
There's a lot to say. Just go slowly. Okay, right.
So you saw this corkscrew. You said people are having a hard time opening up a bottle of wine. We're going to sell it in a magazine. How does it make a profit for you, that first one? What is it about that? How did that first ad do?
This is really challenging my memory here. I don't remember it really making a profit, but I remember it encouraging us to continue. I would give it an encouragement. Because people ordered, it's kind of exciting to open the mailbox. It's almost like opening it today and finding an order or two there. You know, every day we'd rush to the post office. And this is, there's so many analogies between that and email and texting and things like that today. But I mean, we rushed to the post office every day to find a couple orders. It was thrilling, of course. And fortunately, we both had careers, so we could afford to indulge ourselves with this not exactly highly profitable venture.
Okay, I know what you mean. When I even see the PayPal order come in by email today, even if it's one or two, you go, yeah, this is kind of fun. Now, how do I make that happen again and again, faster and faster for more people? Is that what you were feeling?
Precisely. And we said we wanted to offer more things because we also were encouraged by the customers. We had a couple nice letters and people were, wow, this changed my life. There were older people who were, slightly arthritic who could never open a bottle of wine. And this corkscrew made the difference, between pleasure or pain, I guess. That would be a good way to put it.
Okay, so you're selling it in the small little ad in a magazine. What's the next step? Is the next step a catalog?
Next step was a very, very small catalog. You know, I'm very proud. It's hanging on our wall here, our first catalog, and developing a logo. The little guy at that time, we called him Lord Winston. You guys may have seen it. You know, he's gone through a few different iterations, but let's see if I can get this up on the screen there. But there he is, the little guy, and he's been modernized. But he used to have a circle. But he's transcended the 30 years we've been in the business.
Why was creating a logo? Why was having Lord Winston so important for you that that's one of the first things that you did?
Well, having first of all the brand, the wine enthusiast, obviously was a powerful thing that people remembered, and having him adjacent sort of spoke to the image and prestige of the book, and yet it's a little whimsical. You know, as those of you may see, he's a little, he has his little cowlick. He's a sort of has kind of a British look to him and not a lot of hair. But he was the, we tried to make it approachable. That was sort of the idea.
I see. Okay. So you're saying that it was important for you to start off by communicating this the prestige around wine, but also making it more accessible, which is why he had. For a long time, he had the Ascot, but he was also a fun,
exactly.
A fun looking.
We took him from an ad. I don't know if you remember, from an Ascot to a sweater. That's I've never really discussed this before, but you're doing a fine job at an interview. You know, this is.
You know what? I only know that because I read an article about that. That it, apparently was so big, such a big deal that somebody wrote an article or included in their article about you that he just took off his Ascot. That was a big deal.
That was one of the things here.
Okay.
Well, wine is a sexy business, Andrew. You know, there's sports, entertainment, fashion, and wine. Everybody, you know, when we go to parties, people want to talk to us and ask us about our business. If I was selling tires or toilet paper, I don't think they'd be as interested. So we're very fortunate in that regard.
Okay, so so you start a catalog. How do you know what to put into that catalog?
Well, there were certain categories, of course. You know, glassware. We wanted to have a unique proposition for the glassware, which we did. And we wanted to have carrying. We thought about ourselves. You know, and you know, generally as a client, we wanted to have a way to carry it. We wanted a way to chill it. There were so many things you could do with wine. You could dice it. You could slice it. You know, but the real thing that really propelled the business was when we discovered the power of wine storage. We were selling small racks in the beginning, but then the real thing that drove our sales were these multi-$1,000 wine cellars, self-contained cellars, and we managed to create an exclusive with a French company called Urakov, and they and that was really the beginning of moving out of the home, so to speak. We couldn't inventory them in our basement or attic, although we did move to the basement. We were shipping things to our kitchen, and the neighbors were complaining when the trailers were backing up our driveway. So we finally moved out, and I still didn't resign my job in sales because it was pretty lucrative.
I'm sorry. Let's pause it here. I want to fill in the gaps so far of what you've said. This is an exciting story. I don't talk to too many people who start off in an attic and end up with a $100 million a year business. When you did the catalog, how'd you know who to send it to? Did you buy a list somewhere?
Well, rent. There's a huge methodology in renting lists. You know, they're for one-time use. So obviously, there weren't a lot of lists available for wine consumers. But what there were Epicurean lists. I think some of the first lists we used in those days were lists like William Sonoma. So there may be some. So our first mailing was 20,000 catalogs, and I think we tested five lists. One. William Sonoma, there was a catalog. You rent their list for one-time use, you know, and it's a lucrative business for them. It's not as lucrative as it is today. You know, it's diminished today, that business. But it was a way to reach people who had a potential a preponderance. There's a likelihood they might purchase. And, you know, the percentage of return, 1% is considered successful in direct mail. So for every 100 catalogs, if you get one order, you were a happy camper, you know, that's where it was.
It was tough even back then and competitive even back then, because there were so many people in the space. It had already been discovered and it become competitive in the 70s. How did you get your magazine to your catalog to stand out?
It really wasn't competitive. Even the wine business was sort of competitive because there were less consumers of wine. But our business wasn't competitive. The competition was to either have it or not, to create the benefits and communicate the benefits to the consumer, to the con end user, and facilitate them sticking their hands in their pockets and pulling their wallets out and their credit cards and purchasing. In those days, the channel was the phone. So, we weren't placing orders on websites in those days. So it was the phone and the mail. Those were the channels, Today, I hate to flash ahead quickly, but it's kind of interesting, and your viewers might enjoy hearing this. The catalog isn't a channel, it's an ad. It's a targeted ad which drives people to the web, to the phone, and to retail stores. So, those are the channels, the phone, the internet, and the retail. And the catalog has just become an ad. In those days, it was a channel of
I see.
sorts. So.
All right, and 20,000 catalogs is pretty expensive. So you put some, how much money did you invest in the business?
Wow. Gee, I don't think it was that expensive. The whole catalog was about 12 pages, I think. And maybe there were like 15, 20 products in there. And how much money? Oh, I don't, maybe $10,000, which was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
This was 1980. But the real turning point was when the brokers were laughing at me, the brokers who were renting names. They said, oh, I said, well, maybe we'll go to 30 or 40,000 catalogs next time. And they said, oh, this is ludicrous. You have to do a minimum of 100,000 to have an efficient press run and things like that. And when I told my wife Sybil, my partner in this business, she said, absolutely not. She was very frightened, and no way, we can't do 100,000. But I persevered in that, and we managed to secure our first bank loan, $25,000. Yeah, I remember our business plan was pretty cool, actually. I still have it. Little. Anyway.
What was it about the business plan? What was it about the model that you think made sense even back then before you got started?
Wine. It's really all about wine. Wine consumption is growth. The wonderful thing about wine is it's been unabated, the growth in consumption. Even this year, 6% increase on a large base. So, there's net in the last 30 years, wine has never, even in the depths of recession in 07, 08, wine still eked out a 1% consumption increase, because there was so few people drinking wine. And yet, once it's a healthful beverage, it's a civilizing beverage, and once people identified it and how delicious it is, and how, there's so many benefits to wine that more and more people become converts, and that's what's happened over the years. So.
I see. So the big realization was that wine growth was going to grow, and it lived up to that expectation.
Absolutely. And so that was what we told the bankers, who were very frightened, of course. Feel for all of giving us that 25,000. We had to really work hard to convince them.
How do you remember how effective that first catalog was?
I think we had 100 orders.
100 orders from 20,000, so you didn't even hit that 1%.
No, we didn't. Maybe it was more. I don't remember. We hit about 1%, yeah. So we actually did some shows. Actually, now that I remember, 15,000 of them we mailed, 5,000 we went to some little wine shows and consumer wine shows that were around, handed them out. I don't know how effective that was.
Did you break even on it? It sounds like you're saying that
We
you
actually
did.
did. We did break even. We had one big sale. One of our first sales was from a guy, a very interesting fellow. Actually, our first sale was from Senator Heinz, who of the ketchup fame in Pennsylvania. I remember that check. I was very proud of that check, and it was, a few hundred dollars, and they bought a lot of the accessories. So, we had a couple of large orders, which turned the tide for us, convinced us to do the next book, which I think was a quarter of a million, 250, and
So
that was.
everything that I see about catalogs, it feels like such a complicated science of knowing what to place where, how to mix the right products. You're saying when you launched in 1980, it wasn't that way yet. It wasn't.
Well, I don't want to demean the complicated. It is a very sophisticated business. The real thing is the circulation, the database marketing. It's so akin to email marketing today. I mean, actually, it's the grandfather of email marketing.
Yeah.
The merging, the purging, the psychographic research, everything you do to find, particularly with us, it's a niche. The likelihood of someone drinking wine is remote, whereas the likelihood if I was selling toys or clothing, there's a stronger likelihood, although that's more competitive. So a niche business really It was valuable. It's less, of course, as you pointed out, Andrew, it is less of a niche today. Wine is a very highly competitive mainstream business, I call it. And yet we've managed to keep our edge because we've diversified.
Okay, so you're trying different products. How long did it take you to figure out that wine cellars were the hot product to sell?
Well,
wine storage.
It was risky because they were expensive. We didn't believe that anyone would plop down, you know, a few thousand dollars for it. But when the first few orders came in, we were obviously very elated and thrilled. They had both thousands of dollars. That was you know, a windfall for my wife and I. And, you know, I mean, to see these orders, it was just astonishing. At that time, I have to give credit to Bob Parker, who is a famous critic. He identified the 1982 Bordeaux vintage as vintage of the century. Of course, there's many vintages of the century, but this was one that he really hung his hat on and helped propel him. And because of that, people were getting delivery of these wines. They had no place to put them. And so we identified that, and we were able to provide them with these Uruguays, which we were importing. We were actually bringing in containers of them in our next little location above the well, it was in a little center of a small village called Pleasantville. So, and we were pretty astonished at how well they were selling. Then the other thing is, I do need to bring up is, and some of the people who might want to start businesses who are listening to this is, we had the benefit of drop shipping another type of seller from a factory in California. What I mean by that, these were custom sellers, larger ones, wooden, and so the consumers would pay us, and then it took 8 weeks for this seller to be delivered. Of course, we deposited that money right away. I don't know how kosher that was. I probably shouldn't be saying this, but you know, it was too tempting not to. And that was the float that we lived on, and it helped us build our business. And even the French, the Eurocops, they gave us credit, which was, you know, very nice, unusual. So that helped propel and grow the business.
So you get to sit on the revenue that's coming in before you have to spend it to buy the product that people paid for.
Exactly. And then it was delivered, and you know, 8 weeks later, and then we had 30 days to pay those guys. So we actually had a 90-day float. It's kind of interesting. I haven't discussed this in so many years, you know. Really, it's a wonderful walk down memory lane.
I love it. I get so excited to hear stories like this.
Almost everything is analogous to today, you know. And so I guess the next big defining moment in our history, we kept growing and moving to different locations, and it's really it's a similar story the next few years. Of course, you know, the wine cellars were doing very well. We were growing to 5 million, you know, 5-10 million. That was a lot of money, you know, in those days. In 1986 or 87, I identified that there was really a dearth of education for wine. I mean, I wanted more people to drink wine, like Robert Mondavi. You know? Of course, more people to drink wine, I have my own selfish motives, but I certainly thought it was a worthy cause. But we went to, there was only one other wine magazine, and I thought they were doing a pretty poor job because they were only speaking to a very elitist audience of consumers. So I thought there was a dearth of knowledge. So we decided to launch a magazine in 1980 called Wine Times. That was an ill-fated name, but a good idea. Good idea. And a couple of years, I wasn't really a magazine publisher. I didn't really know how, but I kind of liked the idea because I've always enjoyed writing. And I went out and I got Robert Parker wrote for us and Hugh Johnson, the two top wine writers names in the wine field, came aboard. They wrote columns for us, and that got a little attention. And you know, after fashion, I finally figured it out that I needed to sell ads. And also, and the amazing thing, I think actually I'm missing the key point here, that is that we had this wealth of this data of consumers who buy wine cellars and glassware and wine racks, and so we had their addresses and names. So hence it was the synergy. It was sort of that was the terroir. That's the terroir meaning the soil. That was the earth, and out of it a flower grew, and that flower was the magazine. We were enabled to use that data to get people interested in learning more about wine through our magazine. And the magazine, very proud of the magazine. And so, you know, we have the magazine and the catalog. The original brand, here's a catalog with a wine cellar on it. You may be able to see. I'm trying to figure out how to work this out. I can't. So you have the wine cellar gift of the year, but then also we have our, and then, of course, wineenthusiast.com. And then we have our magazine comes out 14 times a year.
Let me pause the story here. I don't know if you noticed, but I keep looking down here because I'm taking notes on what you're saying so I could come back in and fill in the gaps. Here's one of the gaps that I'd like to fill in. You said 5 to 10 million in sales, which of course back then was a lot. Even today, I got news for you. It's a lot of money. Let's go back even smaller. The first million. Do you remember when you and your wife brought in the first million in revenue?
Yeah, I think it was 83.
What was that like? And what did it?
It was shocking, to tell you the truth. I mean, neither one of us, because I mean, we come from solid middle class. So I can't say we were rags to riches or we were poverty. You know, we come from middle class families, but it was quite a special thing to sell $1 million. Doesn't mean that was a profit. You know, they were far more meager than that. But you know, it's a landmark. And
how did you mark that landmark?
Realize that we did it. Come again.
How did you mark that day, or what did you do afterwards? How did you feel?
I felt like I should resign, quit my job. I was selling wine. You know, the crazy thing is this. Up until 1986, I was still selling wine, even though we were working out of our house and we were selling these cells. And, you know, it came to a point of diminishing returns. I was the original, I coined this phrase, wine storage consultant. So I'd sit at the phone and these collectors would call and I'd consult with them on which wine cellar to purchase. Then I'd leave the phone and run out to call out some wine shops to sell them some Gallo, which I was selling in those times. I'd make a 30-cent commission on the cases. Finally, it dawned on me, you know, I think maybe I ought to be sitting home and selling these multi-thousand-dollar wine cellars instead of, you know, schlepping, which is a word that we use in New York, around Westchester. Trying to sell a few cases of wine. So I
resigned. Why did you keep your full-time job schlepping wine for 30 cents a pop but profit? Why did you hold on to it for so long? There was some thinking.
It was
there.
A familiar thing. The family that I worked for, that I really adored and still do to this day, my father had worked for them. And I happened to be a pretty good salesperson. Actually, I was a top salesperson. And it was pretty lucrative, to tell you the truth. I was making... You know, in the early 80s, I was their top sales. I was selling, making like $50,000 a year, which was a lot of money. So it's kind of hard to give that up. You know, it's kind of risky. Who knew? You know, this was all new to us. And we wanted to start a family. And so my wife had resigned. So we, from her career, and she was helping me with this business. And we had our child that you saw on the first daughter in 83, Erica, who you saw on the scale and is now our internet marketing manager. She didn't come here right away. She worked at an SEO firm for a while, you know. Anyway, I digress.
How did you and your wife celebrate those early wins? Was there a special restaurant that you used to go to? Was there something that you would do?
Well, we really were, let's see, did we travel? We went to Europe, you know, our first European trip. And my wife had already traveled around the world, but I had.
All right, here's the other thing that I wanted to come back and ask you about. The magazine. Why start the magazine? Was it to just educate your customers so that they would be more into wine and buy more products later? Or was it because you were hoping to make money off the cover price? You said it wasn't advertising, so that couldn't be it. Why?
If I tell you the true story, you won't believe it.
Oh, I'd love that then.
I've never put this on air, but okay. All right, I'll tell you what happened. In 1986, I was invited out to lunch by a publisher of another magazine, a leading wine magazine. You can guess who it might be. And at that time, we were major advertisers. As a matter of fact, we only had the catalog, okay? So during the course of the lunch, this other publisher pumped me about my business, asking about the cellar business and blah, 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 blah. And I naively, he was about 10 or 15 years older than me. Naively divulged a lot of that. I thought we were going to get some ink. We were going to write about us, you know. It was foolish of me, but I did it. And we were one of their bigger advertisers, actually. We were advertising with them in the early 80s. And suddenly, about a year later, out rolled this other publisher's exact knockoff of our catalog, which, of course, pissed me off to no end, you know? And so I said, well, screw you. I'm going to start a magazine, which was, and I was as dumb about starting, foolish about starting a magazine as he was about starting a catalog. So I, ironically, and this is an interesting story, I viewed the magazine as a catalog, so I put my own ads in the magazine, of course, which is doomed to failure, and I didn't really have the relationships to sell the media. And he did something just as silly. He took pages in his catalog and put ads, and didn't sell ads, he gave ads away to some of the people in the industry, which was very foolish because, when with catalogs, it's a cost per inch game. When you're mailing millions and millions of catalogs, you have to justify each inch of space. There's the paper, the postage, the printing. You don't have that today, but it was go cost per inch analysis, and he didn't do that, because he didn't really understand that business. So both of us were kind of foolish. They say never get in another guy's game. So anyway, but eventually I got it. I figured out how to be in the media business and how to sell at media and. And then in the early 70s, there was a recession. You may I'm sorry, 80, oh boy, 90s. Okay, I'm really dating myself now. In the early 90s, there was a recessionary period, and he failed. He was having some problems. He dropped his catalog. But by then, I'd got the wind under my sails, and I was enjoying it, because the publishing business gives you power. It's a sexy business. It's fun. And I enjoyed it, and, the accessory business, although it was the driver and the economic engine of our business, it's we're selling tchotchkes, we're selling accessories. I'm mixing a little New Yorkisms here, but that's really it was a fun business, and it was a halo of for our business, which turned out to help us with our branding and the image of our firm. So
I
that's
get
kind of.
that. Now, you said that you got it. What did you get about the magazine industry, about running a magazine of your own that suddenly turned things around?
Excellent question. I think the essence of it is it's all about people. You've heard this may sound cliche, but relationships are everything. You build relationships, you build trust, and selling media is selling a concept, and people have to believe in you. And people started to get it. They saw our catalog business. They said, "Wow, he's selling to all these. He's selling these wine cellars. He's selling these glasses. He's selling these wine racks to consumers. He must have a lot of big following of people that might potentially buy my wine." So, hence it created credibility, and so that's what I meant by getting it. Getting it meaning we had to get out there and call on these people and develop a rapport and a relationship and. And there's nothing like selling a schedule of media. It's great for the advertiser, and it's great for the whatever the media might be, TV, radio, magazine in this case, So.
And is it advertising that is a driver for everything else because you can get more subscribers?
Advertising is the principal revenue stream. However, of course, we do our circulation has exploded this year, to tell you the truth.
But when you got it, when I asked you why you got it, I thought you'd say, I knew how to write articles or how to demand articles for my writers that would really excite my audience and
Sure.
get buzz. But no, you talked about advertisers. Why? Why is that so important? That
Well,
why was that the I got it point?
of course, we sort of created a personality cult in our magazine early on. We had Walter Cronkite, Joe Torre. We had a lot, we followed the Morley Safer was one of the most exciting. It sounds a little old. He's still on TV, but he did something which was very defining for the wine business. Totally revolutionized and changed wine consumption in America. He came up with a story called the French Paradox. You may have heard of this. And what he identified was a substance in wine called resveratrol that the French, even though they eat these very, very rich meals, tripe, rich foie gras, their incidence of heart disease is very low. And yet in the United States, it pales in comparison to the heart disease in the United States. And yet, it's because of their consumption of wine. That was the paradox of. This story aired in 1992 in, this is an amazing business story, actually. In 1992 on 60 Minutes, the next month, the sale of red wine, this is how powerful network TV was in those days, grew 40%. There was an explosion in the sale of red wine, 40%. Like E&J Gallo Winery, their leading wine was a wine called Hardy Burgundy, which is pretty good wine made of Petite Syrah. They couldn't keep it in stock. I mean, it was flying out the door. So, you know, the network TV was very powerful, particularly 60 Minutes. So that really, and we had, and I said, well, we got to get him. We interviewed him, and we were the first to get him on our cover, and it attracted attention, you know, in the wine industry.
That was, I see. So when you say you got him, it's not so much, you don't need to get him to be a writer for you. You don't need him consistently. You just need him on the cover. It's getting the right people.
Well, interviewing him. We interviewed him, yes. Well, I mean, that's a harbinger of one of the defining moments in American wine business, the French paradox. So some of your viewers might be interested in knowing about that. You know, there were others, but that was really a very potent and profound one, you know. It associated wine and health. You know, and after the fact, people, you seem smart. If you were holding a glass of wine, I have a delicious glass of Super Tuscan, which is a blend of Cabernet and Sangiovese here. Wow, delicious. What a nose.
What makes you such a good salesman?
You know, I think one of the things about being good in sales, of course, listening. I'm not the greatest listener, but obviously. But it's the common touch, you know, being paying attention to other people and listening to them and listening to their desires and needs. That's one of the things.
Do you have an example of how that helped you out early on when you were selling ads or when you were selling wine storage?
Well, that's interesting. Ads and wine storage, both high-end products, but very different. Well, with the wine cellar already, the thing you need to do is identify the motive. You take a motive and you give it to the buyer. There are four motives for buying a wine cellar: pride, pleasure, I mean the pride of ego, you know, they all have ego, of showing off the wine cellar, the pleasure of drinking delicious wine, properly stored wine is more delicious, the profit wine appreciates in value, you know? And let's see, what is the fourth one? Pleasure, pride, profit? I don't even remember, sorry. We have our sales force. I haven't been selling wine cellars in a while, but it'll come to me. But they're, you know, it's pleasure, pride, profit, well.
But all of that is you selling benefits. How are you able to, how did listening help you make a sale? Or what was it about you specifically?
Well, the thing about listing is because we had a lot of diverse different types of sellers, you'd identify the one that was the most appropriate for that person. They might have, it might be one part of their home. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was in a living room, you'd want a beautiful wood furniture. If it was in a basement, you wouldn't need to have a glass door. Okay? So there were different, I tried to find out each niche, each room that someone might put a wine cellar in, and that was the way you marketed it, you know, and you developed it, and that's what the consultation was all about. To this day, we have 50 guys out there selling wine cellars, and I like to train them. I like to run sales meetings. It was a lot of fun.
You know, that seems like a bit of salesmanship. Just the fact that you called yourself not a salesman, not an operator, not the boss even, but you said that you're a consultant, a wine storage consultant, bit of salesmanship. How did you use descriptions like that in your... Sorry?
Nobody wants to be sold. They want to be helped, you know, or they want direction. That's really what people want.
Okay.
People are fearful of making decisions, and they want you to give them direction.
I see. Is that your daughter getting ready to head out?
Yes, she's getting ready to leave. They're going on a ski trip, her boyfriend and she, they're going up to Stowe, 6-hour drive. And as you probably know, we just got dumped on here with about 2 feet of snow.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere in the sweater today. We tough time. Actually, yesterday was a very interesting day for this interview, I'll tell you. We couldn't open the business. And I came in somehow, my wife and I, and one salesperson, we turned on the phones, and I actually was a consultant again. I haven't done it in 20 years. I really enjoy it. And we've taken goals because we have like 600,000 or 700,000 catalogs hitting now with a sale. And I didn't want to lose that revenue. So not that I handled it well. We do have an overflow service. But
and of but course, when the calls were coming in. You didn't want to lose them. You jumped on the phone.
We came in. We got in and we opened the phones, just the storage line, just the wine cellar line, not the everyday. The others we rolled over. And I sold quite a few wine cellars. It was a lot of fun during the snowstorm.
Hey, why'd you stick with the magazine business after, what'd you call it? You called it Wine Times. When Wine Times wasn't doing well, why'd you stick with it?
Well, it was the brand that wasn't doing well. The magazine was doing fairly well.
How do you know that the brand wasn't doing well, but the magazine was?
It wasn't the right thing. We should have used our own brand, you know, which we ended up doing. Maybe, I don't know, in retrospect, that's a good question. I mean, certainly Wine Enthusiast resonates, you know. Mm-hmm. It's tough. We registered it. We just finally got our registration in China and Hong Kong for that. That wasn't easy, but yeah, intellectual property rights is not on the first thing in people's mind in China, as you know. I go to China, you know. Once the interesting thing is, I've been going to China since the late '80s, and I've seen the changes there and Europe. So I had an opportunity to go to China for manufacturing for the commerce business, manufacturing products there, and I go to Europe to sell ads for the publishing media business. So I was talking about the convergence of media and commerce, which is a very important thing today for everyone. It's very difficult. You look at media companies that are struggling, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, suddenly they're selling things. You know, they have to. They need another revenue stream. And, you know, it's pretty fascinating when you look at the Times. They have their own section of all these things they're selling. And, of course, they all have wine clubs, which is another interesting thing. I think it's great, of course, because when you see a bottle of wine in a newspaper that circulates 2 million, like the Wall Street Journal is over 2 million, the New York Times is 1.1 and 2.7 on Sundays. And even if they're not buying, the reader isn't buying the wine, subliminal impressions are being made about wine to them on a daily basis. So I just love seeing that, you know.
Love I see.
Pictures of wine, you know. It's a memory, you know. I appreciate the Wall Street Journal. Even if Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Zagat, and everyone seems to have a wine club.
So then you're saying you stuck with it because even though the title wasn't a good one, the magazine did well. How did you find it in the early days?
Doing well? Mm-hmm. Well, the magazine was sort of an afterthought, you know. I mean, my wife kept wanting me to drop it, and I refused to do it because it was my baby. You know, define doing well. That's a good question. I don't know if we even did $1 million with the magazine. It was sort of like a little afterthought.
So it wasn't maybe it wasn't that then? Could it be that it was the prestige that it gave you as the publisher and the business as a whole? How did that manifest itself? How did you see that?
You know, publishers are personality cult. Mm-hmm. I hated the other guy. I didn't like him. So I wanted to stick it to him. And he wanted to stick it to me, and I wanted to stay in the business. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with that. Magazine publishers a lot of it is about personality, to tell you the truth. So, you know, and he did everything in his power to destroy us. He went to all of the advertisers and said, don't advertise with them. Don't do this. I don't even want to tell you some of the unscrupulous things he did. And they told me, you know, but you know what? By doing that, he created attention. Why is he so worried about them? You know, I better pay attention to these guys. You know, why? And that was the nascent that helped us actually by him complaining and telling people not to advertise. It brought attention to us.
What are some of the benefits that a publisher gets, or at least that got back when paper was?
Thank you for asking. Boy, that is a real treat. I mean, I'm privileged to, you know, I mean, I have access to visit Philippine Rothschild one day and go to Mouton. Or go with Piero Antonori in Italy. And of course, I knew Robert Mondavi for many years, you know, until he passed away, and Ernest Gallo and all the greats of wine. And, you know, I was treated royally by everyone. And I mean, you know, from humble beginnings. My dad, if my father passed away when I was 19, he was a wine salesman. If he ever saw this, he would, you know, flip out, you know. And, you know, very fortunate to be hobnobbing with these people. I respect them. I admire them. Of course, I adore wine. Wine is my passion. That's the name of our company, Wine Enthusiast. But it's propelled my family, you know, to a wonderful position in life. So we're very proud of wine. And
You ever
it's
say to
going to be
yourself, I'm done. I love wine, but enough already. I need to have some beer, or I need to just get away from the whole thing. And my dad did this. I did this as a career. Sure, it was a passion, but now I'm exhausted from it.
These are some good questions. Well, you know, the wine business is so evolutionary. There's always changes. I mean, there's always something interesting happening. Look at Malbec today from Argentina. Who would have dreamed? I mean, I went to Argentina 10 years ago. The New Zealand fabulous Sauvignon Blanc. You know, I mean, everything is the flavors, the textures, the nuances of wine. It's a very delicious thing. Of course, if I drank a little less wine, I probably would be lighter and fitter. I used to be a pretty good tennis player, and because I've been, I think I, you know, I'm probably 20 pounds more than I should be.
I'm checking
And
you out here on video. You look pretty fit.
I
I didn't know what to expect.
try to stay in shape, but it's not like, you know, the old days. I'm getting up there.
So what I mean is, a lot of people have a hard time staying passionate about a business for a couple of months. You stayed passionate for 30 years about this business, and during years when things weren't going so well, the first thing that you did wasn't a hit. It wasn't there to really encourage, inspire you. You weren't allowing yourself to be inspired by it. Why? How do you do that?
We had some challenged times, and they were pretty recently. It was pretty challenged here because we moved into a vast new facility in the summer of 07, and the business took a major hit. And who's going to buy a wine cellar when they're afraid of losing their job? So it's a very challenging time. We've recovered, not our top line. Our top year was 07, but our profits, we're having record profits this year. Yeah, through some challenging times, you know, but like all businesses that had to persevere during the recession. But I mean, there's so.
How did you survive the recession when you're selling expensive luxury goods at a time when people are looking to Groupon to save 10 bucks on a local Happy
Excellent
Meal?
question. Well, we were always cutting edge. I mean, we had a website. We were one of the first commerce websites with AOL in 1995. We were
Mm-hmm.
transactional. Can you believe this? I mean, it's pretty astonishing when you think about it. We actually were taking orders. We always tried to keep ahead of the of times. And how did we survive the Great Recession?
Yeah, what did you do?
Well, we did some things that was very very difficult for us. We had to lay some people off that had been with us for many years, and we also had to cut salaries. But people, I felt as if we were paying people fairly well here, and but they were loyal. The good people. The crazy thing is, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but of course I will. YPO has a thing about it. You know, I'm in Young President's Organization, or I'm now kicked out because I'm an old president. Sometimes when you let people go, you wonder what they were doing. You know, all these years. Of course, it's a family business, and we weren't publicly traded. We didn't have, we weren't, you know, every quarter we weren't being, you know, under the microscope, or we let things slide. And, you know, we really, in some ways, the recession was good for us because we were able to identify the really strong people. And there was some dead weight, I hate to say it, but, you know, trying to be kind. And there were people here that really were not doing much, and we were paying them six-figure more salaries. And, you know, it really changed our business, and our profits, you know, really skyrocketed. But, you know, with family businesses, you have that. If you know you, because you know, you, generally the biz, you're not as hard-nosed as, you know, ruthless as. I just saw Wall Street last night. I was looking, you know, the new one, and thinking about ruthlessness. But anyway, I shouldn't be bringing that up.
So you cut costs. What else did you do?
Well, that's a good question. That, actually, I have to give our president a lot of credit. We have a president here. He developed a new line of cellars, a more affordable line, called Infinity wine cellars, which, you know, came in at about $1,500 to $1,700, and you know, our Eurocoves were about 3,000. So we needed a mid-price line, and they really took off, and they helped us. And now, you know, the profits would say we are manufacturing them in Asia. Also, I took some of my manufacturing out of China because China was becoming too expensive. I flew to Indonesia. I went to Java, and I found a phenomenal factory there because they have a culture of woodworking there to create these spectacular mahogany racks, cut our costs about 30%. And, you know, we had to do some new resourcing. By the way, Andrew, throughout the whole recession, our magazine business held up. I don't know why, but it held up fairly well. As people needed to market, I guess, you know. The wine business was, I mean, a lot of people would say it was affected, but people would. See, wine is an affordable luxury. It's not like a the housing market could collapse, and which it did, of course. But being, you could always go out and buy a $10 or $20 bottle of wine and still feel good about yourself, no matter how broke you are. And that's the nice thing about wine. And, oh, I have a crazy thing to tell you, actually. Mm-hmm. Do you know that one of the fascinating things about wine is you can walk into a store, a Trader Joe's, and buy a bottle of wine for $2 and at the same time stride confidently into an auction in Hong Kong and buy the same 750 milliliters of fermented grape juice? Recently, a bottle was sold for $234,000. That was Chateau. Of course, I'm talking about Chateau Lafite Rothschild, where then from the 19th century was sold. Same 750, and then the other one I'm talking about is $2. So it's kind of interesting. $2 and two, same quantity. And that just goes to show how artful wine is. You know, it's the marketing, it's the terroir, it's the winemaker, and that's why it's a fascinating business, you know, it really is.
Let me ask you, you ever feel a little out of place in this industry, considering that you're a New York salesman with Yiddish sprinkled in your language, yeah, and everyone else is so highfalutin, they're like Lord Winston back when he had the ascot?
Well, not really.
No, why?
The heritage in the United States, for example, the people that produce, the vast majority of people that were the great vintners are Italian-Americans, like Robert Mondavi, Ernest Gallo, the Sebastianis, the Martinis. The people that sold the wine were the Jews. So, you know, the distributors, many of the distributors are owned by Jewish families, which, you know, I don't want to create stereotypes, but, you know, people do gravitate towards what their parents did. And you know, wine needs to be taken off of its pedestal. It's not a snob. It's a beverage. It's a delicious, healthful beverage. You know, when you're talking about spending $234,000 for a bottle of wine, you can afford to be a little snobby and elitist, but not many people could do that, you know? So it's really a consumable. It's a delicious, wonderful consumable with an artful history behind it.
But you don't ever feel like maybe the outsider in this business, like people are saying, look at the schlepper who's going to sell you a corkscrew and maybe some storage. This, what is he doing here? Oh, my, Mike. And then maybe drop their monocle as you enter the room.
No, because they view me as someone with power, and rightfully so. You know?
Why? Power because of the magazine?
Yeah. Yeah.
I see.
We move the market. You know, as you may know, in the back of our magazine, we rate wines on the 100-point scale. You know, we have thousands of, we rate, you know, 20,000 wines a year. I have journalists in, one of our journalists is in Argentina, who covers Argentina and Spain. And we have a full-time office in Rome with Monica Larner. In Bordeaux, we have Roger Voss. San Francisco, we have Steve Heimhoff. And we have a second in the Northeast. We have a journalist writing and rate, tasting and reviewing. And it gives us power, you know. But we don't abuse it because we're fair. All the wines are rated and reviewed blind. And I can't tell the journalist could give one of our advertisers the worst rating. It's going to print, you know, and they would never. I mean, I've lost a lot of ad sales that way. And then on the other hand, they might give someone a good rating and they want to advertise with us, or they might advertise with us because they realize there's value to advertising. You know, it's not there's merit to it, and there is. You know, we've built many.
As someone who's been in this business for a long time, What do you make of Gary Vaynerchuk? You know that guy, right?
Well, Gary, we actually honored. I haven't told you about our events business, which is a very big part of our business. Some of your listeners might want to see. It's go to wineenthusiast.com, which is our commerce site, or winemag.com, which is a magazine site. There are tons of videos there. And now I want to tell you about we have an events business. I'll get to Gary in a minute. The consumer business. It's always held in a cultural venue. We have thousands of people that come to these events. In New York, it's in Lincoln Center. In Chicago, the Field Museum. In Atlanta, the Aquarium. The Aquarium's amazing. The Opera House in San Francisco. The the Building Museum in D.C., and we're just going to Miami. So you have these spectacular venues, cultural venues, 30 of the top restaurants in each city, 70 wineries, and jazz, and we get 2,000 people, and we do this in 5 different cities. And then, that's our consumer events. And then we have this phenomenal event called Wine Star Awards, and this year, which is the Academy Awards of Wine. I'm the MC, and we hold that at the New York Public Library in the ballroom. It's a very historic place. And this year, we have our Man of the Year, our Lifetime Achievement Award winners. I'm trying to see if I can find an ad for that to show you. And last year, Gary won our Innovator of the Year. Gary did for Innovator of the Year. This year, the Innovator of the Year is a guy named Alain Juppé, who is the former Prime Minister of France. He's now the mayor of Bordeaux, and under his tutelage, the city has a renaissance. I mean, it's the most spectacular. It was kind of I hate to use this word, seedy place, 10 years ago until Juppé came in and became the mayor. And now it's a stunning place with promenades and historical. It's just a beautiful, beautiful city. And of course, it's a jewel of a city, and it's the center of Bordeaux, which is the wine capital of the world, right?
And now I can see, by the way, how having a magazine adds a halo effect to the catalog. You wouldn't be, as a catalog merchant, you wouldn't be associating with the mayor of Bordeaux. You wouldn't be connecting with all these people, and they wouldn't be connecting with your brand.
Definitely not. They wouldn't care about me at all, But the magazine gives us power, and I enjoy it. And anyone would. That's media, but all media does that. Why do you think Rupert Murdoch loves the media business?
Of course. Why are you here on Mixergy? Why are you fixing your Skype so that you and I could have an hour conversation when your daughter's about to go out of town?
You might have enjoyed hearing about our catalog business. Kind of interesting. But here is the Wine Star Awards.
Yep.
And all of these, we have the it's Man of the Year, Winemaker of the Year, Retailer of the Year, Restaurateur of the Year, American Winery of the Year. The Lifetime Achievement Award is going to Baron Eric de Rothschild, the famous banker, right, owner of Chateau Lafite Rothschild, and philanthropist. There's 12 awards, and this is a beautiful star.
And do these guys, they come to the event in person for the award?
Oh, yeah. It's $1,000 a plate. We 400 people come. It's sold out already. It's January 24th.
Is that a profit maker, or is that all going to charity?
This is charity. This is for a nonprofit. The consumer events are for profit. Yeah, we try to make it. This goes to a nonprofit. Okay. And but this is, it's just a fantastic, it's stunning.
I'm starting to think about a nonprofit event as a businessman, but what I'm thinking is, bottom line, it doesn't cost you any money. It's it's free promotion and free way to associate yourself with good people.
Yeah, we have certain ways to monetize it, to tell you the truth. Of course.
Like what?
We congratulatory announcements, I call them, or acknowledgments in our magazine.
Oh, so they buy, the winners will buy these congratulatory, no.
Especially the winners, the people who want to thank the winners and congratulate them. And they might
see.
There's ways to monetize it, but it is it's principally a nonprofit. We do have a foundation, by the way, and we give a lot of money, primarily. We give a lot of money to cinema, to tell you the truth. We love cinema.
To the movie industry.
To aspiring directors and actors. And we sponsor the Italian Film Festival here in New York. We like the cinema.
So what percentage of your business comes from advertising, and what comes from product sales?
Oh, I don't think the advertising.
Roughly. 10% from advertising. So it's still the wine accessories that are the bigger part of your business.
Yeah, sellers are the driver. But,
what percentage is wine sellers, and what percent is everything else?
It's about 50-50. That's an excellent question. The thing about the wine sellers is they are an all-year-round product. Of course, we are a gift-giving business, so it's the end of the year. We are it's very heavy, heavy. Our business is very heavy. We just had a fabulous year. I mean, highly profitable. It was not our top volume year, but it was one of our most profitable years. Yeah, because we did some intelligent things. But also, we increased our margins, and we gave our clients better products and better service, which I mean, that's a watchword for any business that you interview here. So, you know, I mean, the wine industry has had steady growth. Well, you really got to the origins of our business. I haven't had an interview like this.
Believe me, I would have spent a whole hour just on the first 5 years, maybe up until 1986 when everything turned around. I'm that into learning how businesses grow. How about this? Let's finish on a high note. What are some of the perks of success?
Well, of course, you know, I enjoy making money. I'm a capitalist. You know, it's a fabulous thing to have money. And I do travel. Most of my travel there's always a business aspect to it. So the beautiful thing is, I mean, even if wherever I was just in Brazil. Okay, I went. It's kind of interesting. First, I did a very interesting trip. I went to Peru, and then I went to Machu Picchu, and then I flew to Rio. And then I flew to a very fascinating area called Porto Alegre, which is on the Uruguayan border. This is where the Brazilian vineyards are. Mm-hmm. So it's a vacation, sort of, and we're at a wine spa. But at the same time, Wines of Brazil was so thrilled that we were there. They took us on a fabulous trip. I learned about their wines. I was very impressed with some of their wines, particularly their sparkling wine. And their Cabernet Franc was great. And I actually ended up writing a column about it. But I mean, you know, wherever we go, there's usually a vineyard somewhere. I mean, not Antarctica, but you know, virtually every place you go, there is some sort of vineyard that you can participate or get involved with one. Perks of business. I mean, you know, I have a vineyard in my home. I planted a little vineyard. I have 10 acres here in Chappaqua. We live right down the street from the Clintons, actually, so that's pretty nice. We see them, and I planted 150 vines. It's just a vanity vineyard, you know. It's nothing. I'm not going to really make wine, probably. But it's just so beautiful. I lit it up. I spotlit each vine, so you really don't know what the benefits of you know, being successful. It's so exquisite. I'm very proud of my home. We have a beautiful home, and I have a wonderful apartment in Manhattan, in Chelsea, that both of my daughters are living in now, which is in a very hot neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
The High Line, and we're right on 23rd Street, and it's fun to get into. I love the theater. I can go to the theater anytime I want. I love Broadway. And so, you know, I like to sing. I actually started my business. I started out, if you really want to go back, before I started my business, I used to go into the retailers and write songs about the wine and sing it to them. It's true.
At retail events, you would sing to?
Oh, not the events. I write a song. If I had a new product, hypothetically, it was sangria. I write a song about the wine. I'm not going to sing it for you now. But
when you had the full-time job before.
This is when
before you
the wine. Was, yes, yeah, and I would write a song about the wine, and I'd bring some cheese and wine, and taste them, and I'd sing it to them with a sombrero, maybe with sangria. If it was a German wine, I'd have a, you know, Tyrolia hat or something. It was fun, and they always bought it from me, you know. So
you'd walk into a wine cellar store with a sombrero and sangria or whatever the drink happened to be, and you would sing to them and they would buy.
Yeah. You know, to make a sale, first thing you have to do is get attention.
Uh-huh.
Okay? I obviously did that. The second thing you do is you neutralize the buyer's mind by becoming familiar with someone, you know? And then the third thing, of course, is the close. You ask for the order. Some people forget to do that, you know? You don't want to do that. You need to ask for the order in the end, and that's really the culmination of this what you work so hard for, but there's pleasure derived in making the sale, and the pleasure is exquisite. It really is. It's a beautiful thing.
Adam, do you ever, when you were going into a store about to sing, do you ever say to yourself, "What am I doing here? No." You love that. You ever think this guy's gonna laugh at me? He's never gonna buy from me again. No,
they never laugh. They loved it. I mean, who the hell, what kind of crazy guy would do that? Young guy. I was very young, you know, in my early 20s. I came in. I mean, they had boring lives. I hate to say this, but a guy
that's even harder to walk into a place where people are just kind of calm and ho-hum and boring and be the guy who's doing that. I'll tell you why. It sounds ridiculous for me to pick on this one thing and ask questions about it, because it's tough to even make a sale. It's tough to call somebody up and say, "Hey, I have something. I'd like you to take it from me and give me money instead." That's hard for people. It wasn't for you.
Well,
because you grew up in a family where selling was just so common. Is that what it is?
Well, my father was a salesperson. He wasn't like me. I really got my selling prowess from my mom. She was a very personable person and charming, and I mean, I try my best, but you know, you really you need to connect. You know, it's the common. You need to connect with everyone and find out what makes them happy. And when you do that, they'll make you happy. I guess that's one of the messages of the video.
All right.
If you can identify what makes people happy, I think somehow you'll find happiness as well.
All right, let's leave it there. Adam, thanks so much for doing this interview. I hope you'll come back and do another interview with me at some point in the future.
It's a great pleasure. You are a superb interviewer. You extracted things from me I've never said before. So that is the quintessential interviewer. You really are great. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your wonderful show.
Thanks for being on here. I have a lot of respect for what you've done over the years. I really appreciate the interview. And guys, thank you all for watching. I'm Andrew. See you on the website.
Bye-bye.
Bye.